Welcome to the 66th A.W. Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts. In this six-part lecture series entitled The Forest, America in the 1830s, art historian Alexander Nemiroff explores the Hudson River School painters and their contemporaries, focusing on what their art did and did not show of the teeming world around them. The forest serves as a metaphor for the unruly and wooded realms of lived experience to which art can only gesture. The lectures present a fundamentally new account of Thomas Cole, John Cuidor, James Fenimore Cooper, and other artists and writers of that time. This fifth lecture, entitled Emerson, Raphael, and Light Filtering Through Trees, was originally delivered by Professor Nemiroff at the National Gallery of Art on April 30th, 2017. On March 28th, 1833, in Rome, Ralph Waldo Emerson first saw Raphael's Transfiguration. What tenderness and holiness beams from the face of the Christ in that work, he wrote later that year, avowing that Raphael's picture was the greatest he had ever seen. Transposed to the American woods, Raphael's Jesus suggested the transfiguring glories of nature. Yet on the dark forest floor, in the woods of Hawthorne and Cooper, what Pan-like God lurked, idling in isolated pools, sullenly reflecting only on itself.
Okay, welcome. I'm Alexander Nemiroff. This is the fifth of the six Mellon Lectures I'm giving this spring on the topic of the forest, America in the 1830s, and you'll recall that what I'm speaking about is life and art and how the two come together and also split apart in the culture of that time. And today I want to talk about, per my lecture title, light and darkness as qualities or facets of life, then as now. Life and death as qualities of the art and culture we'll explore. How do life and death get into art? How does art shun them or try to avoid them? That's my topic for today. So I want to start with this glorious painting by Raphael, the Transfiguration, from circa 1518 in Rome. And to say that Ralph Waldo Emerson, when he was just 30 years old, went to Rome. He sailed on Christmas Day, 1832. He'd abandoned the ministry, and he sailed for Europe. And on March 28, 1833, he saw this painting, 13 by 9 feet at the Vatican. Just a showstopper to this day in that same location. And it made a tremendous effect on him. What does it show? It shows the scene from Matthew chapter 17, where Jesus has gone up to the mount in the company of three of his apostles, John, Peter, and James. And up there, Jesus has been miraculously surrounded by two Old Testament prophets, Moses and Elijah. There is then a burst of light in which God's voice itself comes down. You can see the apostles shield their eyes from this radiance and says, in effect, this is my son and in him I am well pleased. The light disappears, the astonished apostles look around. Jesus is the only one there. Jesus says, don't say a word of what's happened down here or up here. And then Raphael, uniquely in portrayals of the Transfiguration or inventively, couples this scene that I've just described, which is, after all, only one half of the painting, with the lower half, which details the immediately subsequent episode in Matthew chapter 17, where the rest of the apostles left down on the ordinary earth have been called upon to try to cure this paralytic boy or epileptic boy who is thrust before them by his hopeful, despairing father and his sister. And they, as you can see by their body language, are at sixes and sevens about what to do. Jesus comes down and says, in effect, what's going on here? You know, how little faith you all have. If you had faith, you could move mountains, you could cure this boy, whereupon he does cure instantly the boy of his affliction. So Raphael combines these two things. Emerson, looking at this painting, has his own response to it. He says, this is, you know, he's particularly struck by the face of Jesus. He says the painting goes to one's heart. It seems addressed to you by name. These are two things he says in his diary entry for that day. It's his first day in Rome. And I want to say, though, more particularly why he responds to this, because it carries very much into his philosophy and into our sense of America in the 1830s. So for Emerson, I think his reading of this is that this is who we are in our ordinary life, muddled, confused, packed close together, trying to help perhaps, but being ineffectual also. Too terrestrial are we. And yet, up here is not some sort of separate realm that, you know, is some kind of blessedness that occurs, we might experience only after death, but is a living part of every one of us who in our frail, inconsequential mortality inhabits the lower sphere. This is always a part of us for Emerson. This is what he would call our soul, which is not something with wings that ascends upon at our funeral, but is in fact always with us and is the eternal, the living, the levitating part of us that's always within us, though we scarcely, just like the apostles down here, scarcely even credit ourselves with having such a godliness within us. Four quotations from Emerson now that I feel are informed by Raphael's painting. Four quotations from his mature philosophy for coming from just after his Roman trip. So from this essay, the most famous of his essays called Nature, 1836, Emerson says, "In the woods, a man casts off his years as the snake his slough, and at what period soever his life is always a child. In the woods is perpetual youth," something like this. "Within these plantations of God, a decorum and sanctity reign, a perennial festival is dressed, and the guest sees not how he should tire of them in 1,000 years. In the woods, we return to reason and faith." The woods, if you like, or nature, is a way of sort of moving beyond the email, the traffic jam, the complaints, the ordinariness of our daily lives. It's some other space that's always within us. He says, "There I feel that nothing can befall me in life, no disgrace, no calamity, leaving me my eyes, which nature cannot repair. Standing on the bare ground," and this is probably the most famous sentence in all of Emerson, "my head bathed by the blithe air, all mean egotism vanishes. I become a transparent eyeball. I am nothing. I see all. The currents of the universal being circulate through me. I am part or particle of God." Right there is about being transfigured. It is Raphael come to New England and is, via Emerson, is able to elucidate for us that which is eternal or Jesus-like about us all. Second quotation from the Divinity School address at Harvard from the summer of 1838. Again, Raphael informs this and it allows us to understand the painting on the left as a diagram of our own kind of perpetual livingness as Emerson understands it. "But speak the truth." So he's talking about how lies always demean and belittle. "But speak the truth, and all nature and all spirits help you with unexpected furtherance. Speak the truth, and all things alive or brute are vouchers," that is, testifying to your wellness and your contribution to life. "And the very roots of the grass underground there do seem to stir and move to bear you witness. All evil is so much death or non-entity. Benevolence is absolute and real. And he goes on to say, and keep in mind, this is from someone who has now forsaken organized religion and is pursuing a deeply religious but also secular vision of the soul, says, the perception of this law of laws awakens in the mind a sentiment which we call the religious sentiment, and which makes our highest happiness. Wonderful is its power to charm and to command. It is a mountain air. It is the embalmer of the world, meaning that which makes the world smell sweet. It is myrrh and storax, two kinds of fragrant perfumes made from trees, and chlorine, which has a kind of antiseptic or purifying quality, and rosemary. It makes the sky and the hills sublime, and the silent song of the stars is it. He's saying this is all within us. Also in the Divinity School address, this sentiment is divine and deifying, again, for an individual person. It is the beatitude of man. It makes him, not like this, limited, but illimitable. Through it, the soul knows itself. It corrects the capital mistake of the infant man, and you could say person, who seeks to be great by following the great and hopes to derive advantages from another by showing the fountain of all good to actually be like this in himself, and that he, equally with every man, not just some people, is an inlet into the deeps of reason. When he says, I ought, which means like I ought to do something benevolent and good, when love warms him, when he chooses, warmed from on high, the good and the great deed, then deep melodies wander through his soul from supreme wisdom. This comes down into us. It's always been there, but we activate it, is what he says. Then he can worship and be enlarged by his worship, for he can never go behind this sentiment. There's no sort of peeling it back in the verses of rational skepticism. In the sublimest flights of the soul, rectitude is never surmounted and love is never outgrown. The goodness that we all have within us. And in the American Scholar from 1837, he's talking about the way thought activates something for us that's akin to this kind of vision. And he says, the actions and events of our childhood and youth are now matters of calmest observation. We can all picture these things, and they have for Emerson a kind of levitational endurance or eternity, our childhoods, our experiences. They are like fair pictures in the air, but not so with our recent actions. That means when we're adults. Okay, because with the business with which we now have in hand, the new deed is yet a part of life, like something I did 5 minutes ago or yesterday. It's still a part of life. It remains, therefore, for a time immersed in our unconscious life. But in some contemplative hour, it detaches itself from the life like a ripe fruit to become a thought of the mind. You could call Jesus there an idea about our lives, about our experiences. Instantly, it is raised, and there's that word, transfigured. Notice, it's not transformed. I always tell my students, it's not about transformation, it's about transfiguration. Transfigured, the corruptible, that is our daily lives, is put on incorruption. Henceforth, it is an object of beauty, whatever this thing that has happened to us that we now raise up, however base its origin and neighborhood. In its grub state, this experience we've had yesterday or today or tomorrow, it cannot fly, it cannot shine, it's just a dull grub. But suddenly, without observation, when we activate it with our passion, our intellect, the selfsame thing unfurls beautiful wings and is an angel of wisdom. So is there no fact, no event in our private history, and this is so true, which shall not sooner or later lose its adhesive, inert form, and astonish us by soaring from our body into the empyrean. So this is a very powerful and, case that is still to be thought of highly today or regarded today about the goodness of human beings, though they be but alienated almost perpetually from it. and our own powers. Remember, I spoke about light and darkness, life and death, to live in moments, but even to live beyond our deaths. Is that Emerson? No, it's another person who's now going to introduce me to the flip side of this belief in goodness, light, and eternity. This portrait, which is at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston and is painted by the Philadelphia artist Rembrandt Peale, shows a naturalist, scientist, anatomist foremost named John Godman, who Rembrandt Peale knew in Philadelphia and whose dates in a very short life are 1794 to 1830. John Godman died of tuberculosis like many people did then. Emerson's brothers, at least two of them, did so. Posthumously, in 1833, John Godman's naturalist observations called Rambles of a Naturalist were published. And reading these accounts of him wandering through Maryland, which is where he was from, gives one a sense of things on up high, but also a kind of fundamentally meaningless existence, one that seems always to suggest to him, though he doesn't express it quite like this, why do I have to die? What is the meaning of my short life? Are my accomplishments merely accomplishments and fade with me so that I just become finally some guy staring out from a painting in a museum in the future? And there's one episode that haunts me in this way. It's, if you like, the anti-transfiguration. John Godman is out hunting, being a naturalist, in the woods at night in Maryland. He has word that there are many, many crows, a huge bevy of crows who are settling in for the night in the trees, the pine trees there, and he describes it. We were to leave the road, this is him and his hunting companion, and penetrate several hundred yards among the pine trees, whose proximity to each other and the difficulty of moving between which, on account of the dead branches, has heretofore been stated. So he's kind of having to move sideways through this thick forest in the night without really seeing where he's going. Next, we had to be careful not to alarm the crows before we were ready to act, and at the same time were to advance with cocked guns in our hands. At last, we reached the trees upon which the crows were roosting. So now he's set. There's not Jesus in that flash of light there. There's just this darkness there for this man who's writing this memoir that's ultimately published posthumously. What happens? He's there. He's ready to shoot up into the heavens, which in a way is itself a kind of cry out to God. But as the foliage of the young pines was extremely dense and the birds were full 40 feet above the ground, it was out of the question to distinguish where the greatest number were situated, selecting the trees which appeared by the greater darkness of their summits to be most heavily laden with our game. You know, so seeing where the dark is darker, my companion and I pulled our triggers at the same moment. Then there were considerable outcries from the crows, a heavy shower of pine twigs and leaves, and a deafening roar caused by the sudden rising on the wing of the alarmed sleepers. Out of all that, one crow at length fell near me, which was wounded too badly to fly or retain his perch. And the next day, Godman goes on to say, he's ever the Enlightenment scientist, I know not that I ever derived more pleasure from any anatomical examination than I did from the dissection of its internal ear. The extent and convolutions of its semicircular canals show how highly the sense of hearing is perfected in these creatures. From Emerson's God that is everywhere and that is always infinite within us, to finally this minute token, this fragile microphone of the cosmos that is the one thing that Godman procures in his, you know, mysterious blind quest for some kind of higher meaning that does not exist. And though he would affirm, you know, the integrity and importance of his pursuit of science, his name is finally ironic, or not ironic, I'm not really sure. But it's something to the effect of a cri de coeur and the tiniest of tokens that's left him. So this is a photograph by Gregory Crewdson, made in the year 2014 in Western Massachusetts, where he lives in the small town of Beckett, Massachusetts. It's called the pickup truck. Western Massachusetts around there, as some of you will know who know Gregory's work, is basically his Yoknapatawpha County, or his Wessex of Hardy. It's where his characters are. He portrays his characters in these real life settings. He, almost like the movie director of his own photographs, which are 37 by 50 inches, Cibachrome pictures, supervises every aspect, the location, the selection of the pickup truck, the hiring or casting of the models, sometimes from locals, this young woman with the tan lines, this reclining nude who is actually a man. It all comes to Gregory in infinite preparation beforehand. There's nothing left to chance on the day of the shooting. This is photographed on a mountain outside of Beckett called October Mountain, given its name by Herman Melville, who lived not far by. The trees you see are planted by the WPA in the 1930s. It's a photograph, as I said, from 2014. How will this get us to the 1830s, and how will it help us to explore light and darkness and life and death then and there? In one way, this too, like Godman's exploits among the crows, is finally a meditation about faith or the lack of it. And I'll tell you why I feel this to be the case. When I see naked or semi-clad figures in a forest setting, and when I think of Crewdson's own deep awareness of American history and the kind of resonance of what has happened in Western Massachusetts, I actually think of Indian captivity narratives with these pictures and the pain or dejection that this woman with the tan lines is experiencing, whatever it is meant to connect to a kind of vaster history of scourging, of isolation, of being bereft and isolated in that constitutes a lot of American history. The difference is, however, that those who were taken captive in Western Massachusetts communities in the 17th century, no matter the violence, at least understood that God was with them, even if God was testing them, whereas maybe the same is not the case in the form or the shape of Crewdson's naked or near-naked human beings. So the contrast. Mary Rowlandson, who was abducted from the Massachusetts town of Lancaster on February 10th, 1675, and wrote the founding text in the very long-lived genre of captivity narratives, her text called The Sovereignty and Goodness of God, wrote, describing the Indian attack that day in her village, there was one other villager who was chopped into the head with a hatchet and stripped naked, and yet was crawling up and down. Another man begged them his life, promising them money, but they would not hearken to him, but knocked him in head and stripped him naked and split open his bowels. She is taken off into the woods, Mary Rowlandson is, and endures a captivity, a frightful captivity, but she's ultimately rescued, and she understands it in terms of God's presence in the world. There in 17th century New England, she says, with the italics being hers, "And yet how hath the Lord preserved me in safety? Oh, how the experience that I have had of the goodness of God to me and mine." It's a scourge, it's a challenge, but it ultimately attests to the purposefulness and presence of God. Crewdson's young woman is like Mary Rowlandson without God, and this is what I myself have written about this photograph. Crewdson's world is godless. The gap in the trees here does not open like a vista to another world. It's very narrow. The trees and more trees prosper with a nameless and incoherent beauty, In the quiet of the solitary forest, every individual noise and motion withers in the absence of godly sanction, dying without notice. The cathedral, and Crutzen's pieces here in this series are called the Cathedral of the Pines. The cathedral is still there, but it is empty. The congregation departed, and nature, ravenous and entwining, grows to fill the halls. Crutzen's people, whiplashed by unseen and indiscriminate forces, suffer their torments without the designs of providence. This split between godliness and the absence of God, manifest, say, in the 1830s, is present in the contrast between Emerson and Godwin, let's say. The 1830s, in other words, are a fulcrum point wherein our own more prevalent sense of the godlessness and randomness of the world and what befalls us is beginning to emerge, and the old Puritan dispensation is beginning to disappear. I think Crutzen is aware of Hawthorne and is thinking of that, and I want to now bring him another picture by him into this world of the 1830s in that way. And this is one called Beneath the Bridge, also 2014. Two girls, one of them holding a baby here. It's very difficult to see, but are standing naked by the streaming river here. And what is it that they're standing below? Well, it's a very distinctive structure that some of you may know. Of course, Crutzen's settings, again, are all real settings. You have to imagine almost a Hollywood crew out here making this picture, very carefully planned picture. This is one of the so-called Keystone Arches, which were designed in the very late 1830s and opened for business in 1841 to carry the Western Railroad, then brand new, through the Berkshires, through the most mountainous part of the rail track. These arches were designed by James McNeill Whistler's father, George Washington Whistler, who was a major from West Point and who understood how to build bridges. In fact, so much so that these bridges, I believe, are still in use, almost all of them. Certainly they were until very recently, if not. And although they were designed to bear the weight of a locomotive from 1841, which weighed 12,000 pounds, and though an Amtrak locomotive weighs 415,000 pounds, they still support them just fine. And you know with how much maintenance? Zero maintenance. So Keystone Arches as a marvel of architecture. That is the setting for this picture. And what does the Keystone Arch say to the naked girls? It says, this is progress, as it was in 1841. This is a sign of America is going places. It's moving forward. Marvels of engineering, of transportation, etc. Beneath or unglimpsed by those who travel on these marvels of achievement is some kind of sorrow that happens all the while, that is obscure, utterly lonely, and its obscurity is present even for those who experience it. It's what progress does not acknowledge. A progressive view of a human being does not acknowledge. Who among our authors from the 1830s would be best fitted to understand the secret sorrow that glides and stands beneath the bridges of progress? Wouldn't be Emerson, it would be Hawthorne, who knew this so well. And I think of a story by him called Roger Malvin's Burial from 1831, in which, this is completely Hawthorne's view of human nature, a young man, a good man, is fighting Indians with his father-in-law. His father-in-law out in the wilderness is wounded mortally. The father-in-law says, "Don't try to save me. You'll never be saved yourself. Just leave me to die right here. Go." Finally, Reuben Bourne is the guy's name. He leaves, but he's haunted by guilt, even though he was given permission to do this. He's married to the man's daughter. 18 years later, Reuben Born is hunting with his son Cyrus and with his wife, and as fate would have it, he accidentally shoots his son, mistaking him for a deer, at the very spot where Roger Malvin, his father-in-law, was left to die and rot. And this is what Hawthorne says. There lay the boy asleep, but dreamless, upon the forest leaves. So the parents are just coming upon him. This broad rock is the gravestone. Now this is Reuben talking to his wife, Dorcas, of your near kindred, Dorcas. Your tears will fall at once over your father and your son, right at this one spot. And Hawthorne goes on to say, she heard him not with one wild shriek that seemed to force its way from the sufferer's inmost soul. She sank insensible by the side of her dead boy. At that moment, the withered topmost bough of the oak loosened itself in the stilly air and fell in soft light fragments upon the rock, upon the leaves, upon Reuben, upon his wife and child, and upon Roger Malvin's bones. For Hawthorne, we keep coming back to these primal scenes. It doesn't matter what bridge of progress is built by us or for us. This is how I read this photograph on the right via Hawthorne, and I think therefore through Crutzen. Crutzen's young women beneath the bridge stand before the stream as if despairing of a baptism that would absolve them of their crimes, whatever they are. They have come to this spot as if on purpose, let us meet beneath the bridge, but they look lost. The guilt of nakedness blends with a feeling of obsession and return. There is no such thing as the newborn world, but only a nature that vilifies our innocence by returning us again and again to remote places where we secretly confront our guilt. That's Hawthorne. And I think Crutzen, who's working right there in Hawthorne country, and for whom, as I've said, every detail is considered, and Gregory Crutzen, who as a little boy used to listen to his father was a psychotherapist, and he would listen through the floorboards to these primal sessions, comes by his own feeling of human nature, honestly, and I think extremely deeply. It's funny, though, that this guilt is not nearly the godlessness or nothingness that I've spoken of with the first photograph and with Godman, but is instead something equivalent to a kind of church, a kind of space wherein it is our flaws and our fatedness that we experience with a kind of religious reverence. I mentioned progress, and I want to return to this painting, The Gallery of the Louvre by Samuel Morse, to do two things with it. One is, as you might imagine from what I've said about it before, to attest to its progressive and I think therefore inhuman qualities, but then also to kind of recover it as a part of the human world where life and death can be felt, to palpitate through it, in it, around it. So on the first score, you know, it's maybe not even that surprising to see or find Morse in letters to his buddy James Fenimore Cooper in 1833 liken the progress of the fine arts to the destruction of the forest. And this is the way Morse writes it. If I am to be the pioneer, that is, the woodchopper, and am fitted for it, why should I not glory as much in felling trees and clearing away the rubbish as in showing the decorations suited to a more advanced state of cultivation? In other words, the America needs my painting as much as a forest needs to be cleared. Both are signs of progress, of advance. And he goes on in another letter to Cooper, I find the pioneer business, he's a little disillusioned now, has less of romance in the reality than in the description, and I find some tough stumps to pry up and heavy stones to roll out of the way. It's hard, it's heavy lifting for him to be a one-man superhero of the arts in a craven country, says he. Now, the irony here and what finally is able to bring Morse's picture back to the living world and make it breathe is that the very failure of this painting, no one wanted to see it, The grand tour he had planned quickly seemed like a waste of time. Morse really wanted to offload this picture so he could get on with other things, for example, inventing the telegraph, for which he's much better known. And he sold it at a steep discount to a guy named George Hyde Clark, and it went out where? To the forest. It went out to Clark's idiosyncratic but quite beautiful neoclassical mansion on Lake Otsego in very near Cooperstown, New York. This place called Hyde Hall, Hyde, H-Y-D-E, constructed beginning in 1817 and finished in 1835. The guest, or I should say the entertainment portion of which, the private residence is over here, but the contiguous kind of grand place for entertaining is over here. You can see the trees behind. The facade, of course, faces the lake. We can't see it here. So through this door, the gallery of the Louvre went, and there are two large rooms, this room and this room. It was probably over in this room here, but because the walls are painted red in that room and they're painted, there's still the original plaster white on the left. I'm going to show it to you in its reproduction there in that room. So we're now on that left side room. And if you're wondering what you're seeing, it's one of the mirrors that the three mirrors that Clark purchased in 1833, just at the same time he bought the Gallery of the Louvre, which you see in the reflection here, just seemingly under threat by this kind of jellyfish of spoilation, which is so marvelous in the mirror. And just to give you a better sense of the bearings. So this is a reproduction that's slightly smaller than the actual size of the picture, but it gives you a sense of how the picture would have hung in the space, though, again, it was in that rightmost room, not the leftmost room. But you see the lamp here? That also comes from that same moment, the 1830s. It's a kind of lamp called an argand lamp, a very fashionable and deluxe kind that Clark had purchased from a fancy purveyor in Manhattan called Baldwin Gardner. And Baldwin Gardner is just the purveyor. These were actually made in Birmingham, England by a very famous company called Samuel Messenger and Sons. The very latest in illumination, and I think very related to Morse and progress and light of that kind. How so? You know, most lamps burned by whale oil then. There were, so the people at Hyde Hall tell me, 12 grades of whale oil. But Clark, being a gourmand and knowing full well that whale oil had a very distinctly fishy smell that he didn't want to have interfere with his guests' suppers, went for another kind of lighting called vapor lighting, which was 5 parts alcohol, 1 part turpentine, and that was odorless. And that's what you have to imagine suffusing up through these wicks, these very thick wicks here. This is right off of this lamp here. Imagine the Morse lit up by these. Imagine coming out of your carriage in the night and entering this blazing hall, which was blazing not just by virtue of this fancy new kind of illumination, and in which the Morse would have been a stunningly kind of pulsating visual thing right then and there, but also via the walls. I just said they're white, but they were actually, they're plaster, but they're plaster intermixed with sand. You maybe get a little bit of a sense of the grittiness here. Sand, so I was told, that was imported from a beach on Long Island, especially because it had mica in it, and the mica would glint, of course. And so the light cast by lamps like this would make the walls sparkle and radiate. The Morse was a kind of feast for the eyes there, and though the particulars of the feasts escape me at the moment, one phrase I do remember from the curator's description is oceans of Madeira. So you have to imagine a sumptuous kind of party and also a kind of, I don't know, in its way, a kind of blessed sociality there in what is still largely a wilderness in the 1830s, a light in the surrounding darkness, a brilliant light in which, yes, in that moment, with all these sumptuous material things of the moment, it is good to be alive. But I think what is most poignant about this picture in that location for me, and what ultimately brings it back to life, is the sense of its verse with the surroundings, or its conversation with the surroundings, its acknowledgement that if we step out the front door and look down the whole 8 miles of Lake Otsego to Cooperstown in the distance, and think of the trees, and there's actually an oak tree on the grounds that is from that same time, that it's this darkness and this otherness of nature that Morse's picture knows it is finally powerless to compete with. It can radiate only to a certain extent. It can provide a memorable burst of brightness, but it cannot really impinge on the surrounding darkness in a way that would make a difference. And ultimately, actually, what it portrays most vividly, the painting there in that location, is just the sense of our mortality, its mortality, the way life is a kind of beautiful circle of radiance surrounded by darkness. That lake and the otherness of nature, they come together for me in what I think is the most poignant novel about that lake, which is James Fenimore Cooper's novel called The Deerslayer from 1841. And what you're looking at is a detail from a late 19th century illustration from an edition of that novel, in which, difficult to see, but there's a body being laid to rest in the water, which is Lake Otsego, or Lake Glimmerglass, as Cooper called it, as Chingachgook and Hawkeye and Judith Hutter weep here from their boat. So this body laid to rest is that of Hetty Hutter. There are two sisters in the Deerslayer, Judith and Hetty. They live on this ark, this kind of mobile fortress slash home slash ship in the middle of the lake. It's set many years earlier in the 18th century. There's something about Hetty Hutter, who is presented in the following way as, and these are Cooper's phrases, weak-minded, simple, like, you know, there's something, I can never figure out what her malady is. She just seems to be a simple person, but he presents it in terms of some kind of mental illness, which contrasts with Judith, who's robust, who's beautiful, who was played, I believe, by Rita Moreno in the 1957 version of the film, who is a very full, sexualized being, also very thoughtful and compelling, but Hetty is very different. And there's something about her as she's laid into this lake that just affirms that what she is for Cooper also nature, and in particular, nature in its most extreme and show-stopping otherness. And what do I mean by that? Well, let's look at a passage from The Deerslayer, which, remember, is 1841. The Ark, so this is long before the events here that happen at the end of the novel, had been slowly stealing over the water, the darkness thickening around it, so it's dusk on that lake, just amazing. Though it was easy to see that the gloom of the forest at the southern end of the lake, so where Cooperstown would be, was getting to be distant, while the mountains that lined the sides of the beautiful basin were overshadowing it nearly from side to side. So the mountains, the hills, and the trees on them are kind of adding their darkness to the darkness that's descending on the lake. There was indeed, or you could say however, a narrow stripe of water in the center of the lake where the dim light, dim is a heady word connecting to her, the way she's constantly described, that was still shed from the heavens, fell upon its surface in a line extending north and south down that whole longness, length of the lake I just showed you. a sort of inverted Milky Way. A sort of inverted Milky Way, that's Hetty. Like she, God comes, is in her in this inverted way. Just as the stars are in the lake. She, no wonder she was Cooper's favorite character. She's certainly my favorite character in this book. And long before she dies and is lowered into the lake at the spot where her parents had both been lowered in, after each one of them had died, we hear that Hetty communes with this very place. For an entire summer, she had been in the habit of repairing to the place after nightfall and carefully anchoring her canoe so as not to disturb the body. She would sit and hold fancied conversation, so this simplicity, with the deceased, sing sweet hymns to the evening air, do things that a person in their right mind would not do, and repeat the orisons that the being who now slumbered below and taught her, had taught her in infancy, so her mother in this case. So you might say that Hetty, you know, who dies at the end, with her dies this kind of good Christianity that inverts the Milky Way and makes this narrow stripe of light in the surrounding darkness. You know, it's, if you like, another form of illumination than Morse's. Morse's worldly, kind of poignantly worldly, small burst of light. This is a kind of Christian stripe of light, both there on Lake Otsego. But, and I'm sure that's right, but I think there's something else here too, which really occasions my greater awareness, let's say. And that is the relation of Hetty to reflections and just to a sense, and this is a photograph I took in my hometown of Bennington, Vermont a couple of days ago, of a pond, but the sense that reflections are the autism of nature, or should I say they are the moments when I experience nature itself as most other than me, most indifferent to who I am or how I feel, my projections, my cares, my concerns. Instead, nature is having a conversation with itself all the time. Nature is not sociable. Nature is autistic. Hetty is not autistic, but her relation to her own death, to her own reflection, and if you like, to the narrow stripe of her own eternity is so self-enclosed. That's what gives me the goosebumps, basically. You know, we see ripples on the lake or the calmness of the lake, but nature is always having a conversation with itself. It doesn't care who we are or where we are. Is any form of godliness recoverable in some kind of intensified, vivid way in this time when, yes, Emerson's Raphael is still there for us all as he is to this day? Well, let's consider this artifact, also about light and dark and life and death. Some of you will know exactly what it is. It is the little Bible, almost 5 inches by 3.5 inches by 1.5 inches of Nat Turner. And it is on display at the new National Museum of African American History here in Washington. It has a pretty persuasive background as being the very Bible he would have carried in Southampton, Virginia, in August of 1831, when the slave insurrection led by Nat Turner happened then and there, and which, of course, he had many years before. This Bible is a theory of history for me, a theory of how visions come to us and how they become activated in an individual person with world-changing effect and then remain there in the artifacts that inspired us. And how is that so? Well, in his confessions to Thomas Gray, in the confessions of Nat Turner, which I've quoted before in these lectures, Turner explaining everything to Gray from the prison cell from which he would soon be extracted and hung, says, by way of describing how he was inspired to do to order the killings, he's seen visions in the heavens that he interprets in certain ways. And then he says, and then I found, you know, if he says he found blood on like dew on the corn in the field one day, and then he finds on the leaves in the woods hieroglyphic characters and numbers with the forms of men in different attitudes portrayed in blood and representing the figures I had seen before in the heavens. And now the Holy Ghost had revealed itself to me and made plain the miracles it had shown me. For as the blood of Christ had been shed on this earth and had ascended to heaven for the salvation of sinners, and was now returning to earth again in the form of dew, and as the leaves on the trees bore the impression of the figures I had seen in the heavens, it was plain to me that the Savior was about to lay down the yoke he had borne for the sins of men, and the great day of judgment was at hand. You can think of this Bible as itself a leaf, you know, as something, say, equivalent to William Henry Fox Talbot's photograph of a leaf from 1840 on the left, but as something that whose meanings, whose sacred revelations are to be divined, whose meanings and revelations are ordained in nature, whose otherwise seemingly, meaningless, autistic vibrations and patterns actually resonate with a profound clarion life, a declaration of what needs to be done, of justice being served, of Bible and leaf as each intensities, and this is my theory of history here, intensities that gather into it themselves, the whole tree, the whole life, the stars, bringing it all down into a single pungent object in which the cosmos is expressed. History is the study of these objects. What about Emerson through all of this? We started off with such hope. Can he carry that hope through all the things that happened in America in the 1830s? Yes and no. So on the screen is a work by the English artist named John Flaxman from 1831 of Orestes before Apollo. And this picture gives us a sense of two things in Emerson's philosophy. One is his sense of the artist, the poet, as a god who is separate from other people, separate, not related, separate. And much good comes of that separation, despite what it may sound like coming from my lips, but this is the way Emerson describes it. In Flaxman's drawing of the Eumenides of Aeschylus, these are the Eumenides, Orestes supplicates Apollo, or these are the Furies, I'm sorry, while the Furies sleep on the threshold, the face of the god expresses a shade of regret and compassion, but calm with the conviction of the irreconcilableness of the two spheres. He, the artist, the god, the poet, the philosopher, is born into other politics, into the eternal and beautiful. The man at his feet asks for his interest in turmoils of the earth. Please help us. Please intervene. You're a great man. But these turmoils are things into which his nature cannot enter because he's a god of a kind. And the Eumenides there lying express pictorially this disparity. There's a sleep, a zone of sleep between the world and the god artist. The god is surcharged with his divine destiny. So it sounds like a kind of separation. Of course it is. But by it, we can say something good, or there's a goodness that comes out of it. I always think of Robert Frost's poem, Choose Something Like a Star, in connection with Flaxman and Emerson's account of Flaxman. And it just goes like this, and I think it'll vivify the picture on the right for you. Frost, writing around 1943, says, O star, the fairest one in sight. So, star, this is the person talking. We grant your loftiness the right to some obscurity of cloud. It will not do to say of night, since dark is what brings out your light. Some mystery becomes the proud. But to be wholly taciturn in your reserve is not allowed. Say something to us we can learn by heart, and when alone, repeat. Like, show us how to live. Say something. And it says, I burn. So Emerson's God burns with a separate flame. His point is that artists, those who are chosen, are the guide stars for the rest of us. They damage their generosity to us, their possibilities for us, by stooping into our sphere. They cannot interfere in the travails of the earth, no matter how vivid and horrifying those things are. There is a second sense to this drawing in Emerson's essay Experience, however, that I think speaks to the fact that when he confronts it, he's not the same Emerson that we started out with. And this essay Experience is about the way we can never experience the world. We're numb to it. If you like, these are halves of the same person. This is one of us, our mortal half, beseeching our ethereal, eternal, godlike half to be involved, to get with it, to help us, to give us some word. But there's a separation now. And this is how Emerson says it in Experience. Souls never touch their objects. Very different in 1844 from what I started out talking about today. An innavigable sea washes with silent waves between us and the things we aim at and converse with. And he goes on to say now, very autobiographically, in the death of my son, now more than 2 years ago, I seem to have lost a beautiful estate, but no more. It does not touch me. Something which I fancied was a part of me, which could not be torn away without tearing me, nor enlarged without enriching me, falls off from me and leaves no scar. I grieve that grief can teach me nothing, nor carry me one step into real nature. I cannot experience the world. The Indian who was laid under a curse that the wind should not blow on him, nor water flow to him, nor fire burn him, is a type of us all. The dearest events are summer rain, and we the paracoats, the raincoats, that shed every drop. Nothing is left us now but death. So the regret, the sadness in Apollo has to do with the way that he is cut off from life, from the feeling world that Flaxman's picture expresses below. Flaxman's picture is probably a riff or a take on Raphael's. God on high, supplicant from the messy terrestrial world below. But with what a difference, right? Here, high and low are brought much closer together than they are in their ceremonial stratification of spheres in the Raphael. However, the distance between them is enlarged almost infinitely, endlessly. Contact with the soul of us is now severed. We are separated from the stars, says Emerson. And the most haunting phrase or sentence in that whole essay Experience, which by many is accredited the most moving and almost incredible of Emerson's essays, is the one that goes, sleep lingers all our lifetime about our eyes as night hovers all day in the boughs of the fir tree. So he means by that that just when we would experience the world, be in the moment, it's already kind of swimming with our innate human inability to make contact with life. It's just what being human is about. This is his insight. We're always drowsy, always not awake. It's not because we had a bad day. It's just life. That's what he's saying. But when I look at that sentence, I think also of the night having a very melancholy connotation as well as sleeping connotation. And there's something deathly that's in the fir tree, even at midday, says he. Asher Durand, drawing of the fir of a pine tree from the 1850s, you know, a kind of transfiguration, a kind of presence of the beneficence and God-ordained meaningfulness of the world in lines as slender in the graphite as that which would delineate the vulnerable hip of Jesus on the cross in a drawing from the 15th century in Germany. There is meaning in the world. There is presence. Whatever darkness graphite given in this work is not for Durand, the defeated kind, that it is for Emerson. But this is the way Emerson sees it, and it's true looking at pine trees, everlasting trees, green trees. One sees all too clearly, aided by Emerson's eyes, not only the sleep, but the sadness that resides in them always, even at noon. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.